Hi. Thank you so much for so many people to come. It's so wonderful to see so many faces, so many friendly faces in the audience. It's really, where is Kasim? It is an honour and a privilege to be here chairing the launch of this genuinely brilliant book by Kasim Shepherd. And it's also a great sort of honour to welcome you back, Kasim, back to cities. You're amongst old friends and old colleagues, and of course back to London, which was your home before you went to New York City. Kasim is an urbanist, a filmmaker and a writer, and he was the founding editor-in-chief of Urban Omnibus, the online publication of the Architectural League of New York, and from which the work that he did there is what he's drawn on for this book. And the book is sort of 7 years of thought, research, writing, but also analyzing and contextualizing exemplary urban projects and practices in New York. His work has been exhibited at the Biennale, at the United Nations, just to name a few, and he currently teaches at Columbia. The book is fantastic. I've read it. I think it's important to say that it reads like a book and not like a textbook. It is available to buy after this talk, and you can get signed copies. So that's Christmas tick done. It's also a pleasure to welcome our panelists today. We've got Holly Lewis, who's the co-founder of We Made That, which I think is safe to say a hugely respected architecture and urbanism practice, whose work sits at the intersection between research, strategic master planning, and public realm interventions. And I think they're quite unique in that as a practice, all their work is in the public sector, and have projects in 24 of London's 33 boroughs. And welcome, Holly. Welcome back. And Sven Munder runs various projects in London which explore how the built environment can be used as a catalyst for public engagement. He was the co-founder of Bold Tendencies and Frank's Cafe, which are probably one of the more famous and trailblazing projects in Peckham. And he's currently advising design teams on the use of commercial space and wayfinding in the public realm. I'm your chair for tonight. My name's Julia King. I'm a research fellow at LSE Cities, and most of my work deals with sanitation infrastructure, notably how infrastructure can leverage housing and the subsequent politics surrounding these investments. So how tonight's going to run is that Kasim's going to do, I think he's going to pull out some case studies from the book. And he's going to do a presentation for about half an hour. Holly and Sven are going to respond to that. And then we'll have about half an hour discussion, a panel discussion, then we'll open it up to the floor, because I'm sure you're going to have lots of questions. Enough from me. Welcome, Kasim.
Thank you so much, Julia. It is truly a pleasure to be here. It feels very, very full circle. In many ways, I started my career and sort of inquiry as an urbanist here in London. And I'm so thrilled to also see so many people from literally every single phase of my various London lives. Starting with my first urbanist mentor, Donald McNeil, with whom I studied across the road at King's College, not at the LSE, where I got my first urban degree, and really set me on at least more than a decade now of inquiry into questions of urban space and urban society. And the first real opportunity I had to really investigate those and how those played out through the medium in which I was originally trained, which is as a filmmaker, was right here at the LSE, working with some of the people in this room and with Ricky Burdett and Philip Rhoda on the Venice Biennale in 2006, which was the first time that it explored cities as both the spaces and the societal shifts that were addressing very large cities at that time, which I'll mention very briefly in the talk. And I want to thank all you guys for being here. Thank you to my esteemed panelists. I'm very excited. I've had the opportunity to talk about this book in a number of different cities. This is my first sort of international discussion about city makers. All of the case studies in the book are rooted in the place where I live, New York City. But as I often say, I think New York and London probably have more in common in certain contexts than either one does with the rest of their country. So I'm looking forward to the discussion to really dig into some of the resonances and some of the specificities, some of the ways in which the types of practice that I talk about in this book reflect and reverberate with things that are happening here in London, and some of the ways in which the contexts are perhaps completely distinct and what we can learn from that, because I feel like there's a lot to be said for comparative work, but also work that really explores those kinds of second-order resonances. This is the book, City Makers, The Culture and Craft of Practical Urbanism. And another thing I'm looking forward to discussing a little bit with you guys tonight is what some of those words mean. So perhaps in the discussion in the Q&A, we can pull out what culture means in this context, what craft means in this context. But most importantly, what City Makers itself means. It's an invented word. I didn't invent it, but it is used in a lot of different contexts. But I was really sort of eager to come up with a term that was a little bit more expansive than urbanist. I mean, when I go to a cocktail party and people ask me what I do for a living, I tend to say I'm an urbanist, and then I get, you know, a little bit of a blank stare. Is that a job? What does that mean? But in my mind, I mean, obviously in this context, I think people have associations with what urbanism is, but I tend to think that it evokes the study of urban dynamics, something that is sort of at the remove of observational research, which is an incredibly important form of practice, but it is not necessarily extensive with the widest range of what I'm thinking about when I'm talking about people who are actively not only interpreting urban form, but intervening in urban form in a wide variety of ways. Because I think oftentimes when we think about cities, and we think about how cities are made to the extent that we do, we often think about design projects that are designed and delivered as complete environments in one way or another. This is Brooklyn Bridge Park, which is an example of a sort of innovative public space design. I write about it very favorably in the book. I'm a big fan of this park. I spend time there. But this is by no means the extent of what making city can fully imply. It's one example among many, but too often we sort of stop in our understanding and appreciation of what we value as good city design or the delivery of urban services at this kind of complete environment, this kind of complete public space. Or something like this. This is the 34th Street Ferry Terminal, which I also write about quite favorably in the book as an example of a sort of multitasking infrastructure that deals with waterborne transit, as well as some very innovative use of a variety of clean energy technologies. But this kind of this experience of architecture or this experience of landscape, while both sort of incredibly laudable and interesting fields of design, are by no means the extent of what I'm talking about in this book. I'm also talking about practices like this, the people who actively build our cities and who actively sort of work day in and day out on the physical materiality of city form and city infrastructure, as well as people like this. This is an example I'll talk about in a little bit more detail later of Corona Plaza in Queens, where something as simple as programming cultural events and putting out temporary seating in a previously neglected, in this case, paved over space, is itself a form of city making. I also talk about not just people for whom these are their jobs, right? I do spend the majority of examples in the book are people who are sort of professionally dedicated to city making in one way or another. But I think it's also very, very important within that to also lift up those who dedicate their time when they're not at work to making cities and neighborhoods just a little bit better. So these are both examples that I talk about of sort of the stewardship of urban public land. On your left, you have a volunteer who spends, you know, weekends and nights watering street trees and street swales full of flowers. On the right, we have Beverly, who works when she's not at her full-time job, growing food in a vacant lot in East New York, which is a chronically disinvested over generations neighborhood in the east of Brooklyn. So I'm talking about professionals as well as volunteers. And there's a category that I think by far needs the most lifting up, and this is one of the things that I'm really feel very privileged that I had the opportunity to do in this book, is the people who work in city government. I love this image. This is of a downtown office building near the World Trade Center that has a lot of private sector workers and also a lot of people who work for various city agencies in the building. And I love this this image with the reflection because it sort of speaks to me of the way in times, most of the time I think the way we think about urban public services and urban public servants is in terms of what you can see reflected when something breaks. You know, that's when we think most often about the people whose job it is to deliver urban services, and less time do we spend thinking about the people who are probably working, you know, upstairs in an office on some plan that nobody necessarily has been thinking about in the press or in the public communication with these issues, but is nonetheless, in many cases, the product of an incredible amount of dedication, an incredible amount of passion. We obviously have to hold our public servants to account, but that should not come at the expense of celebrating the dedication that they bring to their form of city making. And part of the reason that I wanted to bring all of these various stories of incredibly diverse different practices together was to hopefully get us a little bit beyond this binary of top-down versus bottom-up. In where I come from in the States, this is symbolized by these two figures, oftentimes in urban discourse, Jane Jacobs and Robert Moses. I think in this room I probably don't have to explain who those people are, but sometimes I do. We tend to sort of have a way of thinking about these things where these things are completely in opposition. You either have the master builders who create their own ideas of efficiency or how cities should work that are completely insensitive to local impacts. And on the other hand, you have community advocacy groups who refer to the bottom and bottom up as oftentimes I find regrettably this undifferentiated mass of community. And what gets lost in the mix there is the people in between, which are some of the examples that I've already laid out, and we'll go into a little bit more detail in a moment. Those people who are bringing professionalized expertise in many cases, are bringing the passion that it takes to dedicate one's volunteer time to making cities and neighborhoods just a little bit better, and are doing this in new kinds of coalitions that I think really deserve to be studied outside of the boundaries of the disciplines in which we've tended to segment our understanding of how cities grow and develop. So that was sort of one of the many dichotomies or sort of received wisdoms that I wanted to get beyond. But I did this in a very particular way, and I want to talk a little bit about the provenance of the book and also sort of some of my own influences as someone who thinks about these issues and crucially thinks about how to represent them, because I think that's a big part of the conversation here. So this all started, as Julia mentioned, as an online magazine called Urban Omnibus, which I was the founding editor way back in 2008. So if everyone can close their eyes and think back to 2008, it was a very different time. In many, many ways than we are dealing with today. When I first got this job, we were still sort of at the crest of the building boom. We had no... Washington was telling us credit markets were still healthy. Everything was going to continue in this irrationally exuberant way. And buildings would continue to sort of heap value upon themselves. Everything was going to be great. Things didn't work out quite that way. Soon after we started thinking about this, the market crashed, in large part because of speculation in the real estate industry and the subprime mortgage crisis. And this had a lot of follow-on effects, not just on the economy, which I think we're all familiar with to a certain extent, but also in how we talked about what cities were, what real estate was, and what communities, what their capacities were. So around this time, in the wake of the financial crash, you saw a very huge contracting of the way in which cities were discussed in the media. Particularly, I mean, one of the most sort of poignant examples of this, around the time that we started this, the New York Times closed its longstanding city section and sort of doubled down both on style coverage and on foreign correspondence at the expense of any kind of local reporting. At the same time, however, because of the sort of proliferation of blogs through what was possible at the internet in those days, and newly possible. I mean, this is just a year after the first iPhone, right? So even though we'd had most people of means in the rich world had access at some level or another to internet infrastructure for, you know, 8 years or so, this was really the first flowering of this great amount of very, very hyper-local communication about what was happening within neighborhoods and within different disciplines. So you had a tremendous amount of communication happening in various, to get wonky for a second, verticals that weren't necessarily cross-pollinating in any particular way. At the same time as the traditional media, which we had relied on for some sense of the urban scale, was completely retreating from urban subject matter, unless it was a real estate mega project or unless it was something that could be covered in the sort of couple column inches a week that would be dedicated to architectural criticism, which of course still tends to treat architecture as an object in an art historical tradition, as opposed to a context that goes beyond single and single-authored buildings. So it was in this context that we really saw that there was so much going on, there were so many exciting, and a lot of this actually was another sort of follow-on effect of the financial crash, is you had a lot of unemployed and underemployed designers and planners and people thinking about cities that suddenly were laid off from their big corporate jobs and were spending a lot more time in their neighborhoods doing everything from setting up miniature golf courses in the vacant lot next door to really spending time investigating what the volunteer opportunities were in their community for taking care of open space or any other number of activities. And so we really wanted to create a forum that would bring all of these different disciplines and these different neighborhoods, but within the context of a particular city, together into one conversation. So that was really the dream of Urban Omnibus, which was started by this organization, the Architectural League of New York, which is a cultural organization that was founded way back in 1881. I love pulling up this ancient slide of the minutes of the very first meeting of the Architectural League of New York, which the purpose was at that time for this organization. In the 1880s, this was a time when there were almost no options for professional study of architecture in the United States. There was a craft tradition, and there was a building tradition, and there was an apprentice tradition, and there was the option of going to Paris. But there were very few educational opportunities for this profession that was professionalizing in a particular way. So a bunch of men, they were all men, got together to create a society for the purpose of architectural study, and they would give each other sketch problems and then invite grandmasters to come and critique them. And this sort of lineage is a mutual education society that would try and invite in designers and design talent and apply those to issues of public concern in New York City is something that has lasted for now over a century. And Urban Omnibus, I think, really springs from this legacy of what that turned into in the last 30 and 40 years of design studies of questions that people were not necessarily thinking about, particularly not in the late 80s and early 90s, thinking about questions of how do you make scattered site affordable housing in disinvested neighborhoods, how do you create schools that are economically viable, that are not the size of a full city block, which was the conventional wisdom at the time. So in 2008, we decided to sort of continue this legacy of really trying to marshal this wide range of design thinking into a common conversation about innovative ideas, about different kinds of practice, about people who are working on neighborhood issues, on infrastructure issues, on housing issues, all into one conversation, and that's what Urban Omnibus came to be. And basically each week, it would primarily, most of the stories that we published were interview-based. So me and my brilliant colleagues, some of whom are possibly here tonight, Shumi Bose, who was here at the very beginning of Urban Omnibus as one of our early interns, and Adam Greenfield, who was an original advisory member, both of whom are now in London, but at the time were helping us out thinking this through. What we would do every week was publish somebody's good idea for the future of cities, and we really wanted this to be the future of cities worldwide, but that had been tried and tested in New York. And as I say, this would range. One week it'd be an architect, the next week a community artist who works on public murals, the next week somebody who works on sewers, and really try to bring these all together into one common conversation that brought together all the neighborhoods of the city as well as all the different sort of approaches to dealing with the subject matter. And what I realized somewhat late in the game, several years in, that I sort of had on my hands, without necessarily thinking of it as such, was an archive, a sort of informal data set of sorts, this really sort of rich oral history of innovative urban practice across all of these different disciplines, and that there was something really valuable in that. There was a lot of value in presenting these serially in a weekly sort of nimble online bloggy publication, but that there was an additional benefit, an additional responsibility that I felt to really try and mine these for what it actually said about how urban practice was evolving and how it should evolve. Because this is not just sort of a report on all the stuff that was happening at a distance. I really was interested to insert into this conversation that I was sort of had been curating questions of ethics, imperatives. Really, I wanted to be normative. I wanted it to be a little bit of a manifesto, but one that was informed by these 7 years of reporting on these stories. And so that, I might go back to this, but I'm going to keep going because I'm much more eager to hear from you guys and from our panelists than to talk about other things. That was sort of what led to me really looking at all the stories that we covered and distilling from them a series of ethical imperatives that would that could thread effortlessly through the description and the narrative accounts of these individuals who were working to make their cities and neighborhoods a little bit better, and weave that through with a broad reading of the intellectual history of the city, because in many cases, especially when we talk about things like innovation, nothing's really ever as new as we think. And in many cases, a lot of the innovations that were sort of coming up as trend lines in the kinds of stories that I was covering, in fact, referred back to either precedents from within sort of design practice or within urban theory, or in many cases were really resonant with fields of study and fields of thinking and the intellectual history of these traditions that are far outside what we can traditionally think of as the design disciplines or the urban development disciplines. So this was a great opportunity for me to re-educate myself. I read a lot of economics. I read a lot of conservation and ecological theory. I read a lot of disciplines that were far outside of my own wheelhouse and comfort zone, which was a great privilege. And one of the things that really united all of the various stories that I then was able to re-narrativize and characterize into this book was something that wasn't necessarily at the front of the mind of each individual practitioner that I would interview and then talk about, but there were three sort of big existential threats that I think really unite a lot of the work that's happening, even if it's not necessarily the motivating, explicit reason why people do something. And that is, of course, responding to the existential threats of climate change, of widening income inequality, particularly in cities like New York and London, but increasingly across the world. And a third crisis, which gets a little bit less airtime, and I think is can't be talked about without... you can't talk about any of those other two without talking about the third one, which is the crisis of trust between citizens and government. So again, that goes back to sort of my desire to lift up sort of public servants in the same sort of vein as I was lifting up brand name architects, in the same vein as I was lifting up sort of community activists. But I think those three broad challenges really helped me to identify what these ethical imperatives were that were really behind driving all of this work. So the first one, the first imperative, the chapters of the book that I talk about are relate to public space, infrastructure, information technology, and housing. And it should be said, obviously, there are enormous realms, very rich and fertile realms of urban practice that are not talked about at all in the book, particularly transportation, as well as other things. But these were the topics that a lot of the most interesting practice that I had been reporting on kind of fell into these buckets. So I was very excited to sort of draw new lines around them. The public space imperative is incorporate long-term use and maintenance along with the practice of citizenship into any discussion of public space design and delivery. And this, for me, really gets to one of the key words that goes throughout the book, not just in the public space chapter, which is stewardship. And it gets back to those images I showed at the beginning, is that we really need to get beyond thinking about how we design and make urban spaces in terms of delivering a complete environment, and instead move and thread through our understanding and expectations, our moral expectations of design practice, as well as urban policy, as well as real estate development, into what happens next and how places evolve and how we can sort of encourage people to, or design into these processes, the ways in which they will be maintained and taken care of and stewarded, in some cases by citizens, in some cases by people whose job it is to do so, but to think about that and to think about the time scheme, not just the day in which you cut the ribbon. This Corona Plaza, I'll just tell you a little bit about it in more specifics. It's a really amazing place, and in the book, I contrast it with the High Line, which I'm sure is an example that many of you are familiar with, at least from pictures if you haven't had a chance to visit it. The High Line is a wonderful, you know, nice public space in many ways, and really sort of got the ball rolling. There's been a tremendous amount of copycat projects of, oh, wait, I have a disused freight line, too, in my city. I want to turn that into a linear park. I don't know that you can really call it a park in terms of what you can actually, kinds of activities you can do there, but it is a really beautifully designed promenade. And everybody now wanted one. And this was seen all of a sudden as the model of this is how we sort of create, how we turn disused infrastructure into public space. Who could argue with that, right? But there are a lot of questions about it. There are a lot of questions about how that works financially, about how it is, the ways in which it is or is not replicable. The High Line has very specific real estate economics because of the neighborhood in which it goes through and the, you know, very famous Hollywood stars who look down on it who are able to be advocates for that preservation and transformation project. And I'm much more interested in stories like this. Corona Plaza was sort of a tangle of traffic-y pavement. It was a little bit of a car park, but an informal one. A lot of these local businesses fronted onto it. And what began as sort of a incremental series of activities of people hanging up Christmas lights, the business owners kind of getting together and saying, wait, what else can we do to really sort of define this space? In the beginning, they did this entirely on their own. But I think it's important to remember that what happened next would not have happened in the same way without powerful institutions taking note of what these local business owners were doing. I think a lot of times when we talk about this kind of sort of tactical urbanism and sort of ephemeral transformation, you know, it's easy to celebrate the local residents who sort of, it was their idea. But in this case, very quickly, they because the place started to be programmed and they started to invite local cultural groups, this is in the most diverse place, one of the most diverse places in the world in terms of nativity, right? So this is a higher concentration of people born in other countries than almost anywhere else in New York, and more languages are spoken in this neighborhood than anywhere else in the United States. But the two sort of predominant groups are immigrants from South Asia and from Latin America, and there were a lot of sort of cultural performance groups that, because of the neighborhood's real estate economics, could never afford, you know, their own sort of performance or rehearsal space. And so in the warm months, this became sort of a de facto theater. And then it was noticed by the Queen's Museum, which is sort of a real sort of international leader in social practice art and in sort of bringing museum capabilities outside of the walls of the museum. And they sort of added some technical assistance into the pie. And then it was noticed by the city's Department of Transportation, which is in charge of the streets, who basically all the DOT did was demap it as a street so that it wasn't legally a street anymore, and then provided some small grants for them to buy these bollards and planters. And really just through that sort of very simple kit of parts, they were able to transform this essentially de facto car park into a really sort of vibrant space that was then not only used by cultural and performing arts groups, but by a lot of social advocacy groups in the neighborhood that also were in dire need of space. Immigrant Movement International, which is sort of a hybrid art immigration advocacy group, set up shop here in one of these disused storefronts, and it really became an incredibly vibrant place. And similarly, I mean, you find in a lot of these stories that I'm telling something that is that runs through almost all design projects in one way or another, which is the ability to turn, you know, challenges and turn liabilities into assets. One of the places where I think that's most extremely visible is in East New York, the neighborhood I mentioned earlier. East New York is a sort of chronically disinvested neighborhood. Right now, its real estate values are exploding, but relative to the rest of what you guys think of as New York in a very different way. But it was, like many disinvested and neglected neighborhoods, because of strategic neglect, as well as redlining, as well as a bunch of sort of racist housing policies, as well as a confluence of factors that that you're familiar with, it was subject to a lot of abandonment and arson in the 70s, and there's a tremendous amount of vacant land. There's also very, very few food stores. And a lot of people sort of celebrate and fetishize urban agriculture. It's not something that is going to be able to scale up to meet the food supply needs of cities like New York or even smaller cities like Cleveland. However, what is amazing to me about the ways in which local residents all over East New York took over these vacant lots and made them into agriculturally productive gardens, I mean, at this point, over 50% of the produce consumed in this neighborhood is grown in this neighborhood. Which is both a sad state of affairs in terms of the amount of supermarkets, as well as a positive state of affairs in terms of the ability of these individuals to transform this land into something that's agriculturally productive. But what I was much more struck with was not just necessarily the food yield, but the ways in which the organizations that kind of organized around turning these lots into agriculturally productive gardens used it as a youth development strategy, used it as sort of public spaces that were safe and legal and people could hang out in as opposed to in other places, and really sort of used it as a people development program in addition to sort of a land development program. I also talk about things that are a little bit more ad hoc and full of mirth. This is an example of some people building birdhouses along the Gowanus Canal, which is near to where I live, which is a putrid, incredibly toxic waterway that has just had generations and generations and generations of chemicals poured into it. But it also is a habitat. And something as simple as a couple guys getting together with their friends on weekends, these were young architects who were out of work after the financial crash, built these sort of low-fidelity, very easy-to-assemble birdhouses, and it created not only this cool object, but it created an entire sort of recruitment strategy for volunteers to help clean up the banks of the canal. Something about being able to recognize this as an ecosystem and actually being able to sort of bring bird watching as an activity into this space completely changed the dynamics in terms of how people were able to organize to get people to come and be interested in this space as a landscape and as an environment, not just as sort of a toxic waste dump. And I think that speaks to another sort of theme that I pick up in the public space chapter is the new kinds of demands that I think we're observing from our public spaces, which is not just spaces for passive leisure or, you know, playing ball, but also for places for us to do things together, to make things together with strangers. And I think that there's a lot of examples in the book of that desire to have a different kind of activity possible. The public space enables active creation of objects with people that you don't necessarily know. The infrastructure imperative is to reconceive infrastructure as a multifunction public good and a constituent element of landscape. And I'm talking here not just about, you know, hardscape infrastructure like this. This is the Verrazano Bridge, which links Brooklyn and Staten Island, and is maybe what we think of when we think of infrastructure. I'm also talking about much softer and under-the-radar things. There was a time, not so long ago, and one of my favorite things that I got to do while writing this book was to really sort of dig deep into the history of different regimes of thought about urban development. There was a time, not so long ago, when we conceived of infrastructure and landscape together as parts of a holistic system. This image always gets a big reaction when I show it in New York City, because once people recognize where it is, which is it now just sort of a series of on-ramps to the Manhattan Bridge and what is now Manhattan's Chinatown, people are shocked that this was ever considered as sort of a grand Beaux-Arts public space where people would sort of promenade around. But that was indicative of, I think, a lot of ways in which infrastructure was seen as an organizing principle for the development of public space as well as housing, and much less so today. Again, I'm not just talking about sort of bridges and roads. I'm also talking about things like this. This is a picture from above of the Staten Island Blue Belt, which is one of my favorite projects that I talk about in the book, of all of them, because it is so far outside what we would normally read about even those of us who think cities are cool and are interested in cities are rarely, I mean, maybe Julia, you're an exception, talking about green infrastructure in terms of 30-year plans to create, to re-engineer wetlands to deal with sewer runoff. There are a lot of really fascinating details about this project, but Staten Island, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is a very, very suburban landscape of primarily single-family homes that developed incredibly fast. After this bridge was built in 1964, the population just exploded exponentially. Because it opened up this largely rural island to land development, and a lot of the times people were buying sight unseen these lots in order to be able to have the American dream of a single family home. And in many cases, that development, in almost all cases, that development preceded any investment in infrastructure, particularly sewage infrastructure. So now we have a condition where rainwater, whenever it rains, splashes off of rooftops and roadways, overwhelming the sewer system and dumping all those toxins directly into the harbor. But it had initially a hydrology of this incredible sort of network of kettlehole ponds and wetlands that a bunch of city planners in the Department of City Planning way back in the 70s realized could be re-engineered with some creative use of buying up some of the unused parcels and assembling them in a particular way to recreate this hydrological system that would naturally slow the flow of water so the toxins didn't all go to the harbor all at the same time. And I tell this story not just as an example of really interesting green infrastructure and, you know, wetland restoration, but also as an example of the man who's been responsible for this for 30 years. His name is Dana Gum. He's been working in a windowless office, you know, miles and miles away from the effects of the stuff that he's working on this for over 30 years, and he's dedicated his life to this project. And that's just one of many examples of things like that that are far outside the cycle of things that we hear about in the newspaper, because there's no controversy here. But there is a tremendous amount of creativity, a tremendous amount of coordination between, you know, archaeologists on the one hand, and water engineers, and sewage engineers, and designers, and landscape people, all to make this work. I also talk in infrastructure things about things like this, speaking of sewers, on the way on the other end of the spectrum. This is a guy named Steve Duncan, who is a sewer diver, but he's also a geographer and a mapper of urban infrastructure. He started out sort of as a punk kid who liked to crawl into places that he wasn't supposed to be, and turned that into a career exploring the Victorian infrastructure of our sewage, and takes these long exposure, sumptuous photographs that really speak to, I think, another key point that runs throughout the whole book, which is the need to make some of these complex systems more legible. He's doing it through fine art photography, but it actually has a lot of very, very, very specific ideas about how to make our infrastructural systems imminent and legible to people as a means of advocating for sophisticated investment. I'm going to skip ahead to the end, because I, again, would like to be much more interested in what everybody else has to say. But I will just go through the last two imperatives. The technology imperative is about thinking inductively, complementing measurement with close observation, and embracing technologies that support rather than disrupt democratic governance. And in this, you know, I'm not just talking about the apps and the sort of the ways in which new technologies are allowing us to share things in ways that are problematic and sort of run afoul of, you know, histories of regulation. Which does form some sort of rough consensus of a social contract, but also things like this that are using technology tools to actually actively distribute the skills to actually build infrastructure. This is the Red Hook Wi-Fi project, which is teaching youth in one of the largest public housing complexes in the States how to build their own internet infrastructure, because after the last big storm in 2012, they were completely without the internet, completely at the mercy of the one internet service provider, and so they decided to build their own and use that as a youth development strategy. And then finally, housing. I talk about the need to reconfigure existing housing to meet shifting demographic needs. And in this, I go through a number of stories of different advocacy groups that are turning renters into homeowners. This is the Urban Homesteading Assistance Board. I get real nerdy into tax policy from the 1890s, which we can talk about later at the bar. I will not bore you with it today. But in the end, and I talk a lot about different strategies that go way beyond what we normally would think of as design to get more use out of what we already have, in particular an advocacy project to turn illegal basement subdivisions into things that are safe and habitable dwellings for exploding populations that are not served by the rental or the sale market currently. So in the end, this is just to recap. These are what the imperatives are, and I sort of conclude the book with the notion that it is my deep belief, one of the reasons I'm so passionate about cities and so fascinated by the people who are passionate about them as well and are curious enough and motivated enough to sort of dedicate either their careers or their lives or their volunteer hours to making them better, is the idea that cities can be an infrastructure of solidarity. We know that cities reproduce very serious inequalities and intensify them. They also have a social potential that we need to activate, and we need to activate it in the context of looking and observing at how all these various different kinds of diverse practices actually can build up into something that can get us into a place where we're not only addressing the climate question or the inequality question or the crisis of trust between cities and government, but also addressing who we are as a society and what we expect from one another. Anytime I walk down any city street in New York or any city street in London, the sheer diversity of people that I'm in proximity with and forced to empathize with is something that I think needs to be activated, and it needs to be activated in a way that also is cognizant of the wide range of ways in which people are actively trying to make their cities and their communities and ultimately the world a little bit of a better place. Thank you.
A short response.
No, I mean, it's a fascinating book. Number one, because it's not about London. And I think there's an important thing. I mean, what we all probably realise is that working in a particular area, you can always get absorbed by it, and then you get blind. And I think it's one of a wonderful opportunity to sort of step out of it, and it reminds you, you make new connections and all that. I had a problem a lot in the start, sort of, when I sort of engaged with the city in Peckham, and sort of got like years and years and years, and sort of embedded deeper and deeper, and then I reached the blind spot, and I had to consciously step out again. And I think it's an important thing, time and again, to sort of do that and refocus. So that's number one, it's fantastic, and perhaps we can have a debate later on about what that comparison. I mean, what struck me really, and I think it's a wonderful thing, and it needs a lot of work on many levels, is the sort of the local government and the individual in there. And there's a second notion in your book, which I thought was really interesting, the tactical urbanism. Mm-hmm. And so that's two elements which I think are important. Number one, there hasn't been a single project that has delivered something which I'm sort of happy with, where there wasn't that kind of relationship where people stepped out of the comfort zone, they stepped away from being risk averse, they stepped away from a local plan or something like that and sort of took action and a bit of a risk. And I think that only happens if you establish a situation of trust, mm-hmm. mutual trust. And I think that's coming from both ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's certainly people who are sitting in these local authorities or, you know, the mayor's office, but also the people who do the activism. Sometimes it can come quite quickly by shouting, we all know these situations, but that, and often it's a deadlock. And so where everyone stands within that larger conversation to realize they're human beings and there's a lot of creativity. I thought that was the most inspiring mm-hmm. thing, and I completely concur. I couldn't have made that statement in that way, but sort of opened my eyes, and I can say, yes, that's amazing. And I think in terms of the tactical urbanism that you talked about in the book, in terms of intervening in particular situations and sort of developing tangible results, I don't want to like skew the definition of what you said. I mean, there's also, I think, sort of a level of tactical urbanism, if you want to say, if you want a better word, that looks at that level of engagement between private individuals and government structures, and sort of try to work the systems we have, almost like with the Blue Belt, mm-hmm. whether that's the new London plan we're just mm-hmm. looking at, you know. So, I mean, there's loads of ways of engaging with it and having a conversation. We just need to do it, you know. And then this, after it's sort of instated, it's sort of the question of how do you interpret it. And most often you can find ways of actually making it work for a particular place, you know, in the way that mm-hmm. this plaza has been sort of taken off the highway register. And so I think that tactical urbanism should really reach also in that sort of, at that level.
It absolutely has to. I mean, I think so tactical urbanism, as it's commonly understood, refers to a very specific and, I think, narrower field of practice than the range of things that I'm talking about. It's definitely in there, and Corona Plaza is definitely an example. But oftentimes when people are talking about tactical urbanism, they're talking about ephemeral ways of kind of making places prettier or more dynamic that are oftentimes complicit with incoming groups that are maybe have more means than people who have traditionally lived in a neighborhood, which, you know, it's consonant with. I tried to not mention the word gentrification at all in this entire book. I'm not sure I succeeded, but there are a lot of questions about that. I think where it's a really useful form of practice, and this is where I get to practical urbanism, which is what it is in the subtitle of this book, is when those kinds of energies are marshaled in collaboration with a strong public sector. Because I think too often the way in which, I even use a British example of the, you know, you guys remember the big society conversation, which in the U.S. was the 1,000 points of light, you know, which were both conservative ideologies that were sort of co-opting voluntarism to essentially ask people to do for themselves what government used to do, which is in many ways incredibly regressive. You know, that's all fine, well and dandy when everybody works normal hours and has a lot of time and energy. But, you know, we focus a lot in cities on the inequality of people's wealth in terms of their income, but there's also a tremendous amount of inequality in terms of people who are time poor versus time rich, and those don't necessarily always map onto each other. So we can't necessarily celebrate tactical urbanism without being cognizant of the ways in which it has been co-opted by federal policies in a lot of rich countries to be a smokescreen for the retreat of public services at the local level.
No, to that, I think we're all seeing from the same sheet, you know, but that's exactly what I'm meant. I mean, so the, and we all agree, probably practicing sort of the practical urbanism. It was more like sort of, is it almost like a new playing field where that kind of tactical, quite ephemeral, could extend to the relationship between structures or sort of agents in the whole field, whether that's a local authority, somebody who's doing a sort of volunteer project, somebody who's master planning a road or something like that, where we can play these seemingly very fixed structures and sort of crisscross them, and sort of ownership boundaries sort of are not quite always black and white, you know. Design process, you know, it doesn't have to just end with like sort of a consultation, and only goes to, you know, there are lots of tools one could use and sort of to disrupt that, not just for a moment, but then it has sort of a lasting impact. You know.
And do you want to come in?
Sure. Yeah. Do I need to? I don't know what the deal is with these guys.
Yes.
That work?
Yeah.
I think
that helps.
Okay. Okay. Great. So I thought, because we've read the book. You wrote the book. We've read the book. You guys, you haven't read the book. So I thought there were two particular quotes from it that kind of struck home with me. One from you and one from Jay-Z. One of which you've just completely spoken about, so I don't need to dwell on it too much, but there was one where you're talking about the urban agriculture in East New York, and it says that while illustrative of public space stewardship, this thing in East New York, it shouldn't be taken as a romantic call for city dwellers everywhere to roll up their sleeves and provide for themselves what the government used to provide. And I think that's exactly what you've just been talking about, and that for us in the work that we do, working, delivering public spaces, but also working with the kind of structural systems around those public spaces, high streets particularly with Julia, that we can go into a place and see, it would be great in Burnt Oak High Street, for example, in Barnet, area of very high factors of multiple deprivation, incredibly diverse. We can go in and say, it would be great if these shop owners had a collective voice. We could talk to them, we could deal with that, the council could engage with that. That'd be fantastic. And we can put some resources into trying to make that happen, trying to bring the business association together, running some meetings for them, showing them the ropes of these things. But ultimately, those people are giving all of their time and energy and effort and psychological commitment to just getting by, to just making the business work. And so some of these things about bottom-up movements really make me worry for that very reason, is that they can be incredibly exclusive. So that's quote number one. Then quote number two, you all want to hear the Jay-Z. So this is from particularly the housing section, I think. But he's talking about Marcy, where he grew up. Anybody knows about that? So he says, in places like Marcy, there are people who know the ins and outs of government bureaucracies, police procedures, and sentencing guidelines, who spend half of their lives in dirty waiting rooms, on plastic chairs, waiting for someone to call their name. But for all of this involvement, the government might as well be the weather, because a lot of us don't think that we have anything to do with it. And that, it underpins what we are interested in, that we made that, is that this, I know this is talking about the criminal justice system, it's not something that I know so much about, but it might as well be talking about the built environment, because we just don't understand, or we collectively in the general public just don't understand how the built environment gets made. It's so completely opaque, it's like the dark arts. And this, I think, for the particular sector of the engagement with government, for me, is the thing that is so difficult to
And I think there's so much, there's a lot of emphasis, and I think people understand more or less that community engagement normatively is a good thing, but without any real emphasis, and there's a lot of emphasis, especially now, because of what's technologically possible, on the tools that might enable new forms of engagement, without anywhere near commensurate levels of attention in making the system legible in the first place. And I think that's a huge missed opportunity.
I mean, I'd like to actually go back to this theme of stewardship, which is huge and a huge bit of your book. And I mean, although I think this issue of the politics of knowledge in itself is really important, but and I want to go back to stewardship in context of the United Kingdom, where what we've seen since 2011 and the Localism Act, and you talked about sort of big society, sort of politics of that, is that what the Localism Act has done is that sort of it's devolved power to people. That's the intention. But it hasn't devolved any fiscal power. So it's like, make decisions, but you've got no money to do anything with this, with those decision making. And I was just wondering if maybe you, Holly, wanted to reflect on that in the UK, and if you wanted to pick up on sort of what it means to have these stewardship roles when the money's just going elsewhere.
So my particular experience of that sort of context in the UK is more related to neighbourhood planning, mm-hmm. where, although, as you say, there isn't much fiscal support whilst you're doing it, there is this incredible promise that if you're able to navigate your way through this crazy, complicated system, you too can have 20% of the community infrastructure levy. So the planning game, the money that the state gets for you being allowed to build the thing, if you've got your neighbourhood plan in place, you can get some of that money. So there is a promise of money. But to get from where you are now, with 21 people in a room drawing a line around this is my neighbourhood, to the place where you can get the 20% of the £1 billion tower that's just been built on Blackfriars, is never going to happen. Or where it does happen, it's in very kind of simplified areas. Like, the way that it happens in London is in NIMBY areas, basically,
yeah.
where everybody agrees and we can draw a line around our houses because they all look the same. And that is a tragedy, because the idea of people sitting around in their evenings and weekends talking about how to make cities better is just beautiful to me.
Mm-hmm.
But that there is no support structure for those people, and this lack of legibility about how to navigate the system is horrible.
Because maybe then, Kasim, if I can sort of appendage your response, because something that I think is an issue with stewardship and what you're talking about, and it sort of touches on that, is that if it doesn't attend to the sort of structural inequalities, you've got a problem. So you can kind of steward your way through something, but ultimately you're not really changing the big picture of why we're in the problem in the first place. And I think your book is very exciting, but one of my worries is that a lot of these projects perhaps are happening on the margins, and I wondered if you wanted to reflect on that about... But equally, they're attending to, like, the Red Hook project, which is a pity you couldn't go into it more, but it's about bringing Wi-Fi. I think that is a project that's trying to sort of slam down and change these structural conditions of how people are kept poor. But also I worry that these projects are also kind of for the marginalised and on the margins. You know, exactly what you said, when they're not NIMBYists, basically.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the examples that I talked about today are dealing with, in many cases, conditions of entrenched and intergenerational poverty. That's not the whole extent of the whole thing. I mean, I write just as favorably about the design and financing of Grand Central Terminal, which is, you know, but I think there's two kinds of marginalization that need to be addressed. One is, of course, the social marginalization, which is obvious, and the ways in which that marginalization maps on to specific kinds of vulnerabilities that are made more acute in the context of stronger storms. And, you know, I mean, the Red Hook example is not just, they're geographically marginal. They're in a place that's completely cut off from the rest of the city services because Robert Moses made a highway that actually literally cut it off from the rest of Brooklyn. And it's entirely in low-level land in the floodplain. So, I mean, it's not just that they're sort of economically marginalized from... they're geographically marginalized. One of the benefits of that Wi-Fi program was also that they created an app that would track where the one bus is that takes them to the subway station. But then there's the disciplinary marginalization, which I think is something that every people in institutions like this really need to think hard about. I mean, you know, yes, landscape architecture, for example, is increasingly sort of expected to and celebrates certain forms of resilience, but primarily sort of as an aesthetic and as kind of the nice extra percentage over, you know, parks and gardens continuing to be sort of the dominant form. So I think there's a need to address the marginalization of these kinds of practices within pedagogy specifically. I mean, one of the things that I often say in conversations about this that I think is absolutely going to be an imperative to sort of bringing this stuff closer to the center, and I don't know how you do this. Maybe you guys, you know, educators can think about it more, but how do we make it so that the top graduates in architecture, engineering, landscape architecture, economics want to go and work for their council, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a cool thing to do, which it was at a certain point in the States. Yeah. And
we're trying really hard.
Well, they're good times. I mean, Freud and Kantor just started employing architects. I mean, that's since maybe the 60s that they're back in. I mean, there's also, maybe you should talk to Open City, you know, the person who's there. He thinks that urban design will be the MBA of the 21st century. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's an idea of bubbling up and things happening, but I think it is definitely a very important question.
And that's, I think, necessary to deal with the internal marginalization of some of these practices.
I mean, one of my also critiques, too, is that sort of all these practices tend to have kind of like a bourgeois middle class citizenship as its end game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'd love to live in a world where that's not the only sort of trajectory that
Absolutely.
We're on. But Sven, do you want to come in on this?
No, I think there's one point, and I think that's around the professional. There's also a point where you said we don't need to invent every 5 minutes something new. I think that's in your introduction.
Yeah.
And I think that's so true how I perceive it. Mm-hmm. In the sense, we have lots of mechanisms. We have really great architecture schools. We have a great planning department, and so on. And I think it's often when I see these processes happen, when we're in delivery mode, when we're sort of building a particular piece of infrastructure or a larger development for housing, there's sort of gridlock and people sort of get frustrated in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And often, for example, architects are sort of bogged down by, you know, levels and levels and levels and levels of sort of consultancy on transport. And, you know, and sometimes it's very hard to hear the voice of the architect or hear the voice of the landscape architect. And sometimes it's like that's what we're sort of trying when we're teaching as well, sort of, you know, open it up and say, yes, you can, but you need to really push hard to get the idea through. And often you don't need to do the tokenistic extra bit at the end. You know, you can really engineer it into how you arrange that block. And does it have to be a block? You know, that, I mean, sometimes it's like the civil servants, there's a lot of creativity and a lot of...
And it's not just government and public policy that we need to sort of have more aligned with people thinking about design and planning. It's also finance models. I mean, one of the ways, you know, that I talk about in the final chapter, and it's, I think, by far the most sort of, from a policy perspective, complex, is new strategies to sort of stabilize land markets and I talk about some of the community land trusts, and I know that's an idea that's gaining some traction in London and other parts of the UK, I assume. But there has to be, and again, this is a question of pedagogy, but also somehow making it cool for you know, the people who are interested in designing things, and the people who are interested in developing and paying for things, to have more of a shared vocabulary. I mean, even the word development means that. I teach in a school of architecture which has a real estate program too, and the word development means something completely different in the two classrooms.
Yeah.
You know, and then, so, I mean, there needs to be a little bit more shared vocabulary.
Because, I mean, on the housing front, I don't know if it's, I mean, right now in London, there is this huge, I think it's huge from the sort of a citizen's perspective, this fight against the Haringey HDV. And, you know, in terms of sort of what an individual can do, this is largely being fought by a pensioner with a £5,000 budget against Lendlease of the Haygate estate ilk. And, you know, so one of my... How do we have these sort of stewardships that can endure, let's say, the processes of regeneration, which isn't a year. This is, you know, this is over a decade, too, from when something's earmarked for regeneration to when it's happening. And so... That's what I appreciate the book is also celebrating that. But then how can we help fund these things where this guy, you know, Peter's doing this from a kind of some website and and his neighbours, that's just not good enough. And I don't, I think professionally, I don't know what what I can do against that. And that's sometimes one of my worries when we celebrate people doing so much for nothing, because we have to put the imperative for the money to land where it should land. I don't know, but I don't want to be on a downer about stewardship. I don't do. Is there anything in terms of the housing?
I mean, I think another theme that runs through a lot of the different examples across the chapters is how to design systems that distribute capacity. So a powerful example that I'm thinking of right now, I mean, it goes through the Red Hook Wi-Fi is a great example of that, where it's like, okay, we're not just sort of taking ownership as a community of our internet infrastructure, we're building it ourselves, and therefore teaching skills that will be useful in an economy that requires these skills without any investment in teaching them. But you also have that in some of the stories I tell in the housing chapter of people, of organizations like the Urban Homesteading Assistance Board that really tried to turn renters into owners in a during the abandonment crisis in the 70s when the city was bankrupt and there was, you know, it was much more economically viable for landlords to milk their rent rolls for a certain number of years and just stop maintaining the buildings altogether. And then the city had found itself in the uncomfortable position of being a totally ill-equipped slumlord because all these went into receivership. And anyway, so there were a lot of abandoned buildings, but they all had a couple families in them that refused to leave who had some kind of passionate desire to stay for whatever reason or couldn't leave for any number of reasons. And this organization identified a lot of those people and tried to to develop the technical assistance skills to allow them to rehabilitate their own buildings and convince the city that they should sell these buildings for a dollar and they could become cooperative housing apartment buildings. So I think, you know, sort of looking for examples that have that kind of time scale in mind is critical. And it can't, I mean, this is another problem with the tactical urbanism is that it's for the optics of what it looks like in a particular moment, and it does not change any of the structural things behind that. So thinking about things that really do sort of question our key assumptions about things like, does the ownership of the land and the ownership of the building have to go together all the time? Can we separate those two things? I mean, that requires a tremendous amount of creativity, but also a tremendous amount of vision on the part of the local government officials who might be able to be in a position to implement something like that.
I think something that also really interests me from the book and potentially has that potential to kind of demand more from cities or municipalities is this idea of infrastructure for public good. Mm-hmm. And I think looking back in historically, you know, things like sewage infrastructure did that, where like our sewage system built 40,000 sort of affordable homes and great public spaces that endure today. And it's failing for similar reasons like the Staten Island project failed, not because there's too much, not because it can't handle the shit, it can't handle the water.
Yeah.
And so, but you know, our investment is going towards trying to sort of airbrush that as a problem and do these large infrastructures that has no kind of notion of the civic and for public good. And for me, that's like one of the most kind of strong ideas for how we can practically move forward. I don't know if either of you...
I mean,
Thames Tideway is the strong way to move forward. I mean, it's a curious thing, the Thames Tideway. And the sort of subtle way in which...
I don't know anything about the Thames Tideway. Could you explain it?
So our sewers do this thing. They overflow
when it rains.
It overflows into the river, and the river's disgusting. So a private company, of which Thames Water are part of, I think, actually, are building a whole new sewer under the river called the Thames Tideway, which is basically an overflow, like a bath overflow, but for the rest of the system. So at every point where currently the river overflows into the river, the sewers overflow into the river, it will now overflow into the new tunnel.
Super sewer.
And where does that go?
And then it goes out and gets treated.
But there was a lot of opposition because this problem could have just been attended to by having sustainable drainage.
Right.
But what's very curious about it is that the places where it meets the existing sewer system, so it's just a sort of appendage to the existing sewer system, are all very prominent locations on the riverbank. So at each one of those points, there's like a connecting place which has a bit of public land on top of it so that the trucks can get in and service the thing. So there's all these little new public spaces, like a little string of them along the river that's associated with this sewer.
Which is really exciting to see how that's going to materialise.
To see, but like, The game could have been raised.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a huge missed opportunity for London that just...
It's amazing that we do that. And we actually do infrastructure really well. There are some challenges, but we do it.
Yeah.
Like Crossrail is happening.
Yeah.
Crossrail 2 probably is happening. There's big ways that infrastructure changes the city, and those are potentially massive opportunities to change it in a better way. And
they're social as well as infrastructural. I mean, one of the things that I remember, so I lived in London in 2004 and 2006, and there was a sense, because I didn't have any, deep knowledge of the city before then, but I felt like I was watching a transformation, not just in more efficient buses, but in a demographic shift of for whom it was acceptable to take the bus. And that was where an infrastructural play like had profound social implications, I think, and that congestion pricing had a part to do with it, and these things that were sold primarily in terms of cleaning the air and having less traffic. I'm not saying it produced, new coalitions of like cross-class community organizing potential. However, as an outside observer, it is. We have an incredibly disinvested public transportation system in New York City. It does run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but it's but only poor people of color take the bus still, and that's because of where the bus goes, and it's because the routes have not changed, even though the financial clusters of where jobs are have changed dramatically. And it's just like simple things like that we can think of in an infrastructural way. But thinking about it purely in terms of an infrastructural way has led to infrastructure investment from a policy and a finance perspective that's so tightly fit to purpose that it's completely incapable of adapting, even though we now have an economy that fetishizes disruption and change and innovation, that we haven't created structures in which that kind of adaptability and agility is able to be put into the ways in which, from a policy perspective, we think about public goods. And that, I think one of the things we need to do is tell stories. I mean, one of the things that I hope the book sort of starts a conversation about is that I don't separate in this book those people who are interpreting these systems and making them legible from those who are intervening in them in a particular way. And I think both of those are constituent elements and mutually constitutive of city making, that we're making cities by telling stories about what cities are and how they work, in addition to making cities by actually making physical infrastructure and physical forms. And I think that that's an important part of how we can get beyond thinking about these things in their silos towards places where we can really actually have a conversation about public goods and what the public means vis-a-vis all these practices.
So, on that wonderful note, any questions or comments from the floor? Is there anyone else so we can get you ready? Okay, great. So we'll take those two questions from the center of the floor.
I'm Laura Belkine. I'm... I teach around London and I'm finishing a PhD at Harvard in urban studies. Following from your last comment, I mean, I was really interested in the fact that urban omnibus is associated with a professional organization. The Architectural League is a kind of, self-organized REBA, in a sense. And yet, in some ways, you see a kind of absence of professionals in some of the cases that you show. Accepting unemployed professionals who have a little extra time to build birdhouses and things. And so I was wondering whether your storytelling raised some conversations within the Architecture League about the changing nature of the architectural profession and how architects and other professionals might need to kind of rethink what they do professionally. Because I think there is a disconnect in New York City between projects like the High Line, which are, maybe there are too many designers and too many professionals versus the more self-organized kinds of or more improvised public spaces that you see created alongside it.
We take one more from...
Hi, thank you. My name's Adele. I study at UCL Sustainable Urbanism. My background, though, is in anthropology. And I'm interested in the intersection of anthropology and other professionals who work in the built environment. And I was wondering, like more specifically in terms of ethnographic research methods, how they could be used to potentially formalize assessments of livability, like these kind of key terms that people throw around to dictate many things, but there doesn't really seem to be a best practice for assessing this.
But I think those are a great pair because they actually go hand in hand. I know that ethnography and ethnographic practice is very methodologically rigorous and goes beyond sort of the kind of storytelling that I'm talking about, but they both, I think, the questions of sort of how do we narrate to ourselves what we want these sort of professional interventions to be, I think, is incredibly important. To the first question, I mean, I think absolutely there's a tremendous amount of... So this, you know, the book doesn't really talk about that many architectural projects, qua architectural projects, but it absolutely was conceived in a context in which people who were professionally involved one way or another with architecture were the original intended audience, or not the intended audience, but the original sort of native audience to the website. And there was, I think, within that, a response to a demand question, which was that you had a lot of primarily sort of younger professionals who were sort of rediscovering the public realm in a way that it had not been taught to them, and were also rediscovering what architects had been really interested in the 70s, you know, which was very much concerned with questions of social justice and the public. And then we kind of forgot about that and had this sort of formalist moment of high fashion and high failure. But the schools haven't necessarily caught up across the board. I mean, I teach in an architecture school at Columbia, and the students like would love to take classes on like the financing of public infrastructure in Bolivia, but instead they're learning about the Grays and the Whites and the Parc de Villette competition, and it's, you know, that's an extreme exaggeration, but you know, I think it talks about sort of the disconnect, the generational disconnect between questions of expanding scale, which also raises complicated questions for practice. But absolutely, I think there's a tremendous amount of desire and interest. I think what where within the professions where it comes against a hard stop is people are really interested in hearing these stories and are excited when people that they're professionally associated with are involved in such stories. But then as soon as you start asking questions of who's going to pay for it and who is the client, they're like, oh, wait, that sounds hard. I would love to work on public projects if, like, some wonderful, enlightened client with a budget came around and asked me to. And I'm like, well, maybe we could.
You want to pick up on that?
Yeah.
I think I can. So I don't know how we managed it. But we have managed to make that work, to work in the public sector, and we also happen to have 3 LSE Cities graduates in the practice. Not a design background, though, right? Mm-hmm. They're economists or whatever it is that you would
come out
with.
Social science.
They're urbanists. Urbanists, but none of them from design background. So that's kind of interesting to me. And the ability to do that work and for it to be valued in the public sector exists. I don't know the US context, but here, the public sector is still doing stuff. It's still somehow either controlling, like setting planning regulations or plans for areas to control the development that we so desperately want and need in the new houses, or spending the money that's coming in from having that development happen. So it's absolutely true that the public sector is being devastated, but it's not like it's not dead on the table. There's something happening there, and we've been able to find a way to engage with that and to make fruitful products come from it. Just by sheer belligerence. And then the second question was about ethnographic methods, and I think you should read High Streets for All, which is the study that Julia and I worked on together, but using using those kind of methodologies, which is talking to people and writing down what you find and finding that you can actually measure that, you can say some important things about the measures that come out of it. 51% of people on London's high streets are not in employment, compared with 27% across London. High streets are a good catchment for people that you might consider marginalised or underrepresented. You can find that. You can put stats on it, and that's valuable. I'm really pleased that that piece of work, which was commissioned by the Mayor's Office, now has some representation in the new London plan, which came out last week. So there's reference to the social value of London's high streets.
So it's not just that we can do these studies and they sit there and that's very nice, but they can be there and then they can inform planning policy and spatial policy and hopefully then inform developments in those places or change in those places. And there is a direct link between those things. I think it's about finding the points of influence. And for me, that's planning policy.
Yeah, I would go one step further. I totally agree. I mean, could you talk to our architecture students? Because I think it's at that level that raising the awareness and have that cross-disciplinary cooperation is a huge hunger amongst people who want to study an area, whether it's like, yes, there's sort of mapping tools, and I think that those people would like to reach out because I think they totally get it that the next generation of architects cannot just stop at the drawing board, that they have to do deep tissue research into an area to actually come up with solutions. And that almost comes to the next point when you were talking about enlightened plants. There's an interesting trend that the development projects get bigger and bigger. I mean, let's think Brent Cross South, 7,500 units. I mean, you can just go on and on and on. They get massive.
Nine Elms.
But, I mean, you could say, okay, well, there's certain problems with it. There's one quite interesting development. Often, they're joint ventures with the local authority. And that has huge, huge problems. But what also happens is that certain things get sort of put into these joint ventures where there's a tension because they have, obviously, a public, they're answerable to the public in a much more direct way because there are councillors involved, there's a chief executive, and so on. And we just see that in Harrogate, massive car crash. I don't think that, well, it's obviously a problem, but it's also an opportunity to actually have that conversation and like revisit certain things. And there often it sort of gets, there's certain budgets, well, not always, but I'm just saying that people start to think. So local authority tools are sort of put into these massive legal frameworks, and suddenly you have a commission that is partially backed by policy and all of that. And we're by no means anywhere in a great place with that. But then those projects getting bigger actually makes these projects semi-public, private, and there's new spaces we just need to explore how we can exploit them best.
We need to be practical urbanists.
It's tough.
The plug for the book.
It's tough, but I think it's not just negative. You know, there's a lot of room to push right in there, and I think basing that on research and great design ideas is
and that's
is,
why these case studies
path.
Are so valuable.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Right, we've got one. Yeah, we'll take those two.
Well, the mic's going over. The one other thing I'll add to the ethnographic point, which is just more conceptual, is I think ethnographic methods can be very, very one of the things that I think is absolutely imperative for all of this practice is to get beyond occupancy as the point in time at which we evaluate quality in the built environment. And I think ethnographic methods and sort of other forms of observational qualitative social science, I talk a lot in this about sort of inductive method versus deductive method in the technology chapter and the need to sort of proceed from observation and proceed from the particulars to the general rather than the other way around. And I think ethnographic methods have a lot to tell other kinds of urbanists about because we're seeing a return to positivism, I think, in this very alarming way because of the availability of big data. And so the positivist sort of idea that you could sort of make these grand theories, which was discredited because of these like large top-down masterstrokes that you know communities revolted against, is now sort of subtly at the margins and then not so subtly taking over in the quantification and sort of the ubiquity with which all of our built environment is instrumented with sensors. And I think we need to push back against that, and the only way to do so is through qualitative observation, including ethnographic methods.
People.
Yeah. Right. Hi, I'm Jonathan, Director of Public Services at the RSA. Something you said, Helen, really resonated with my research experience, which is about the importance of investing in the kind of the infrastructure and the networks that support social entrepreneurs and city makers to be able to come forward and do their best work and apply themselves. So the example of neighborhood planning is a really good one in the England context and something I recognize. So for Kasim and for others, how do we convince people who, there are lots of people with resources who want to invest in making cities better places because that's a good value proposition. There's a lot of value in doing that. But how do we convince them to invest in the kind of unsexy infrastructure kind of pieces that bring forward, you know, 100 social entrepreneurs who have a half-baked idea but need to be connected to their neighbors, to ideas, to resources, to tools, to capacities, to skills, rather than in, you know, a current model which I guess prioritizes funding the frontline intervention, the thing that you can cut the ribbon on, the thing that looks good on the front of Evening Standard Homes and Properties section, etc.
Let me take one more question
then. Hi, I'm Jessica. I'm a student at MSc Urban Studies at UCL. Thank you for the examples. They are very exciting. I'm just thinking whether there are any examples, both endable or you came across that the government or the local authority actually they try to intervene or they take up the position, and if yes, how eventually those negotiation took place, because they all sounds very good, but as you mentioned, they are very marginal. Sometimes when we want to expand, the government comes and how these projects develop eventually. And my second question is in these projects, are there any cases there are actually different opinions happening within these small projects? And if yes, is that eventually the professionals, they are the one who make the decision, or how the negotiations being
totally
done? Yes.
I'll take the second one, and then I have a very short answer for the first one, and then I want to pass the first one off back to you guys. Yes, there are lots of examples, both in this book and much more abounding, of places where the sort of innovative germ of the idea came directly from government or from landowners or from sort of powerful institutional actors. The Staten Island Blue Belt, that's sort of one of the purposes of that example. That was completely initiated by hardworking bureaucrats who noticed a problem and figured out a way to deal with it. And it's not really, it's marginal in the sense that nobody knows about this project because it's not that sexy and there's no ribbon you can cut on it. It's a series of holes in the ground surrounded by reeds, you know? So they've completely avoided public acclaim, but it also, they've managed to continually get it funded, and they planned it out in such a way that required a tremendous amount of they had to learn a whole bunch of real estate economics and real estate law, because it's actually an example also of a benign use of eminent domain to carve up sort of little pieces of people's backyards in order to create the stream system continuity. So, there are very much examples of that, and within all of these, of course, there's internal dissent all the time, and of course there are hierarchies of power in terms of who has which levers on any sort of given team, and too often the person who has sort of the final say is the person who owns the land. So I think there's a tremendous amount of need to really understand that, because I think we often talk, all of us, about innovations that don't necessarily deal with land ownership in the ways in which we would actually really need to do so. And that, I get into that a little bit more in depth in the housing chapter. To the first question, which I think is an incredibly important question, I think you're totally right, Jonathan. There's a number of, there's plenty of money out there, and a lot of investors obviously see the value of urban land. It's why they're turning, Manhattan, for example, the new architecture of Manhattan is essentially a series of Swiss bank accounts. It's a place to park capital in real estate, when in fact that capital could be going to a similar thing that would have an analogous return on investment, possibly, but in a way that could actually distribute resources in a more equitable way. I don't really have a great answer for that, but I again think that storytelling has to be a huge part of it. We have to actually talk about the value propositions in ways that don't just talk about the ethics, which I would love to be able to talk about all day long, but also talk about the ethics in line with the return on investment possibility, while also telling other stories of things that have a completely different value proposition that maybe doesn't have a financial outlay in the same way, but we need to talk about those things together instead of segmenting, these are the for-profit projects, and these are the non-profit projects, and these are the B Corps, and these are the, I think if we can talk about those in terms of not just value proposition financially, but values, then we can get a lot more people on board. I don't know, what do you guys think?
So I think, as you were speaking, the first thing that I was thinking about in terms of how do we get all of that lovely money that's washing around, how do we put that in the right places? I was in St. Petersburg a couple of months ago, and there's a bit called New Holland. It's like an island. It used to be a boatyard, I think. And it's been done up, and, you know, it's very lovely, and the paving's nice, and they've got special manhole covers that are made especially for New Holland. You're like, wow, and how did this happen? They're like, Abramovich did this. He individually, one man, paid for the whole thing. And I don't think that I like that. I think I like that cities are shared. I think that they belong to all of us. And for that reason, I think the answer to your question is a strong public sector that's resourced enough to get the bits out of the sexy bits of development that make other people money and put it into the places that it needs to go that are not so sexy. And in some ways, we sort of have that ish at the moment, but I don't think it's as strong as it could be. I don't think it's as well connected with, I think there's a sort of democratic deficit in a way in the ways in which that gets spent, and I think that's a problem. But I think it's right that it remains in the public sector, that it's something that's accountable to everybody.